State Fair's meeting to order. It is 8:05, and we have a full complement with exception of Representative Porter. So we have Representative Vogan, Representative Willis, Representative Robinson, Representative Ivan, Representative Green, and myself, Representative James. First thing that I want to take up, if you'll notice on the schedule, is House Bill 435, which is State Training and Employment Program. That's the STEP program. And I'd like to waive this from committee if there isn't any objections so we can get this moving through the system. Is there any objections to waiving this bill? Okay, then I will waive it on the floor this afternoon. Thank you. Moving on, the next one on the agenda, House Bill 393 has already been waived from committee. And so the next bill up is House Bill 452, Calculation of State Aid to Education. We have the administration here to present this piece of legislation.
Sure. Good morning, Madam Chairman. For the record, I'm Rick Cross, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Education, and I'm here to discuss the committee substitute for House Bill 452. Committee substitute, as it is before you, is essentially the same system we have in place today for calculating state aid to schools, with one notable exception, and that exception is that it makes a payment to REAAs of $500 per unit to increase the floor to ensure that we meet the federal disparity test in the 96-97 school year. In order to recover the money that it costs to make that $500 payment, this committee substitute increases the deductible federal impact aid for those districts that would get the $500 payment by 5%. And therefore, by increasing the deductible, we recover a large portion of the payment that would be made in order to increase the value of the unit in those districts. There is one exception. There is one difference from this committee substitute and the original Bill 452. In the original Bill 452, the single site school districts and the calculation for the payment that's been made to them for quite a few years now was included within the foundation. We strongly recommend that single site payment be placed back into this bill for two reasons. The first is that in calculating the federal disparity test, the federal government has looked at the single site issue for a number of years now and has encouraged us to have an all-encompassing formula that would include all of the calculations that we use for foundation payment, and they have let us know that they would strongly prefer that if the state is going to meet the calculation, going to continue to make the payment, that the payment be included as a part of the foundation. The other is that it is a payment that's been made for, I think, at least four years now, and it has become a consistent course of doing business, and therefore we recommend that the single site calculation be placed back into the bill. I have the pros from the department and would be happy to, either I or they would be happy to answer any questions members of the committee might have. I appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Cross. I have one question. can you respond to the fiscal note? First of all, I thought that what we were doing is a reshifting, but we really are adding more money into the formula funding. Is that correct?
We are. The calculation of the going from 90 to 95% on the deduction does not exactly match the payment that would be made to the REAAs. So the fiscal note, which I believe is, $223,000, represents the difference between what we would pay out in the $500 per unit payment and what we would recover from going from 90 to 95%. So it was our attempt in the department in defining the bill to get it to as close to zero as possible. But when you're dealing with such large numbers that it didn't come out exactly to zero.
Second question. Does the $1,000 that we've been giving to for single sites, I believe it, or whatever it is, the amount that we've been giving to single sites, is that have any effect at all on the disparity test?
I'd ask Eddie Jeans from the department to answer that.
For the record, my name is Eddie Jeans with the Department of Education, Division of School Finance. The single site allocation has been based on a formula that has been before the legislature a number of times, although the table has not actually been included in the foundation formula. As Deputy Cross pointed out, the department would recommend that table be included in the foundation formula in this bill. The single site allocations do affect the disparity test because they are not associated with instructional units as the appropriations are made now outside of the foundation formula. So it increases the unit value of those single site school districts, where if the table is adopted and put back into the foundation formula, instructional units then generate those dollars so that those dollars then do not have any value outside of the unit value itself.
You really lost me.
Yeah, I was going
to say, could you try that one more time? Try that one more time. I understand the formula. I've always understood the formula since I came here 4 years ago, but I've never quite understood exactly how the single site, and I did understand also that single sites have an additional cost than when there's a multiple sites of schools. But I never did understand, and I might be embarrassed to admit this, just exactly what that formula for single site appropriation was, how it affected any kind of disparity.
If disparity it doesn't matter how many units you receive. That doesn't affect disparity. It's the value of the unit that affects disparity. And so if you're giving a district more units, you're not necessarily making a disparate situation occur. If you're making their unit value significantly greater than another district's unit value, there is where the problem lies. And so if in the case of single sites, we can make the payment by giving more units, I'm getting it too. make it so that we're paying more units as opposed to increasing the unit value for that district, it ensures that we're not creating wide disparity between the value of the units, and therefore it's a better way to do it.
Representative Robinson?
Well, just a question, being I said in Hess when we took the tables out, and I objected at that point. What's the ramifications of not having that in the bill?
Through the chair, Representative Robinson, actually the U.S. Department of Education Office of Impact Aid has put the Department of Education on notice that those payments should be included in the foundation formula, because these payments are being made outside of the formula. It's like it's circumventing the equalized plan. That is one of the reasons why the department recommends that these payments be included. And as you had asked previously, Representative James, Deputy Commissioner Cross pointed out, it increases the value. The appropriation is made outside of the formula now, so the districts still have the same number of units, but they have this additional revenue that increases their unit value, and that's what causes the disparity, the additional revenue outside of the formula.
Okay, can you explain to me on the table then what the, and I'm looking at it here, I think, where it has the area differential and the single site units adjustment. What is the support then for finding that the unit value of a single site school should be larger than the unit value in non-single site schools? You're saying that's what we've been doing. We've been saying they have this many units in the way we define units, But that isn't good enough for them. They need a little bit more because it costs them more to do their school. So we need to raise their unit value, but their units are the same as measured around the state. Can you tell me why it is, why it is that they need more money? Is it because of their geographic location? Is it because they're a single site and they don't have the benefit of sharing superintendents and those kinds of things? Or what exactly is the culprit that makes them need more?
Partially, it has to do with the economies of scale and the fact that the foundation program provides instructional units for a site. And being a single site district, they get to go through this table once, and it really does not provide enough dollars to cover administrative costs. Other school districts around the state, as you get larger, economies of scale kick in, and you have enough revenue to provide your administrative services. Or in the case where we have multiple sites, the school districts go through this table multiple times, and there's a what we call front loading, which provides them with that additional money for their administrative costs. Being a single site school district, they do not have the benefit of going through the table multiple times. They go through it once, and if they're a small site, as the single sites are, they just don't generate sufficient funds for their administrative costs overhead.
Okay, one of the things that I have a problem bringing myself to where I was to where I am now, and I think about when I was in high school, the principal of the high school was also the school superintendent, and also he taught two math classes, and so I would think that in these small schools, and this is the argument, and I'm not saying I have a position on this one way or the other, but this is an argument that I hear, that just because they're a small school doesn't mean that they necessarily have more of these costs. It means they combine them, and one person can do more things, and so that the appropriate, the changes ought not to be that different. Now, I know there's another argument for that, and all I'm doing is trying to substantiate that other argument. So,
Representative James, many of the single-site school districts, the superintendent provides the function of the superintendent, the business manager. In some cases, they do teach classes. I can't say that's true in all cases, but in some of them. So they are already providing the functions that a larger school district has specialized people to provide those functions.
So where does the additional administrative cost come in then? Specifically, what kinds of things do single-site schools have that is more expensive for them than others?
Madam Chairman, it's the ratio of the administrative cost to the total cost of the operation. That the larger the district, the much smaller that ratio is going to be. And so the, of course, our preferred method of compensating them for that is to give them more units, not increase their unit value. But somehow they have to make up that ratio. The percentage of their total business function as a percentage of their total operation must be a larger percentage, because to pay five people doesn't cost 5% of what it costs to pay 100 people.
Yeah, okay, I'm starting to get the picture. Is there anyone else who has any questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Willis.
In the changes that this bill would make with regard to funding, is there any tilt away from urban school districts toward rural school districts? Is it affected? Is the money received by urban school districts diminished in any way?
Through the chair, the single site calculation wouldn't cause that to happen, because we've been making the single site calculation payment for some time now. So the only change in this bill that shifts any funds at all is the payment to the REAAs to meet disparity. And we've proposed a mechanism that tries to recover from the same places that we're paying out those dollars. So the only real shift out of over a $600 million program would be the $223,000 in the fiscal note. And that money would be paid by paying out and recovering. It's the difference between what we pay out and what we recover to the RAAs.
But on that note, author not, I don't see the fiscal note that was provided with the original bill here in my packet, and it's probably been trashed because it goes away, I think, after you have a new substitute. But it would appear to me that by taking out the single sites part of this formula, that there would have been a fiscal impact on this piece of legislation. Because now, rather than now in it being included in the formula, as opposed to having a separate issue, would make this particular piece of legislation cover more. So it seemed to me like that if we took it out, there should have been a reduction, a corresponding reduction in the fiscal note.
Representative James, the Department of Education did not build the single site change the table in the fiscal note, because the single site appropriation is currently built into the department's budget, and it has been an appropriation that the legislature has made on an annual basis. Therefore, the fiscal note that the department did prepare dealt only with the adjustments to the REA school districts and the increase in the $500 per instructional unit. So the $223,000 fiscal note is still the correct fiscal note, in our opinion.
You know, I just want to say for the record, I certainly am interested in fairness and equity throughout the state in education, and don't want my questions to be construed that I have any separation between urban and rural. My only thing is that when I talk to the people in my district and they ask me about these things, I have to be able to explain my position. And that's the reason why I want to understand it, and when I don't, I have to ask questions. So, you know, I understand the concerns that we have in the urban area, that there's a lot of distress because of the extra money that we spend in the rural areas for schools and education. I'm very sensitive to the needs in the people in the rural area, and I'm not interested in having any kind of inequity between the kids there and the kids in town. So I just wanted to make that perfectly clear. Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm sorry, I probably stepped out when you were maybe explaining this. We had a family emergency, but could you explain to me why in this period of time when we're trying to achieve austerity that the single-site schools, the administration can't be combined so that you don't need the intensity of single-site schools, that you could combine several of those, and maybe you're talking about the economy of scale, realize a better economy of scale by collecting rather than individual?
Through the chair, Representative Green, the issue of combining schools has been in school districts.
Yeah, I'm only thinking about the administrative portion.
Right, has been studied, and we'd be glad to get you the copies of the most recent study that was done on that. And the bottom line on it is that while in theory, one would think that it would save lots and lots of money. In fact, relative to the total cost of the public school function in the state, it really doesn't get you much.
Would it save $223,000?
I'll be sure to get you a copy of the study that was done.
Through the chair,
yes.
Representative Green, the $223,000 has to do with the change in the formula that would increase the deductible impact aid to regional education attendance areas, and does not have to do with the single site issue. The single site issue, the department, like I said, is built into the budget for 97. The legislature has made an annual appropriation to the single site school districts since 1988, with the exception of 1 year that I believe was fiscal year 91. So the $223,000 fiscal note before you has to do with this change dealing with the REAs so that we can meet the federal disparity test, and does not deal with the single site issue.
Yeah. And on that issue, follow up on Representative Green's question, is there school districts that are in the rural areas that have their superintendent who's not located in the same area? Are there superintendents, as an example, that might be living and operating out of Anchorage or some other urban area that are out there?
Yes, there are.
For the record, James Elliott, Division of School Finance, yes, there are.
Okay.
In one case that I know of, there's a superintendent in Anchorage for the Chugach School District. There's also a superintendent in Fairbanks for the Yukon-Koyukuk School District.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Biden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to make sure that I saw and heard correctly that the single-site school funding is going to be the legislation is amending it to include them year after, each year from here on? Because each year we have to try and include those on the outside of the funding formula. And
to respond to your question, Representative Ivan, this has been the discussion has been that that part of this piece of legislation was taken out in the Hess Committee. It is not in there currently. The way it is currently, there's an additional $500, which is offset by impact aid to pay for it, with the exception of $223,000 statewide. But the funding of the single sites, if we were to pass the CS as it is currently written, would continue the process we've had of funding the single site separately.
Right.
Okay? That's where we are. Any other questions?
One final thing, if I could, on disparity. We use the term so much that I don't think we define enough. There's only three states in the country that are including their federal payments as a part of their foundation. And Alaska is by far the biggest player when you look at it as a percentage of the total budget. It's $35 million for the state of Alaska that we're including in the foundation. And that's of our $600-plus million program. If you look at Kansas, for example, which is another state that includes it, their payment is only $8 million of over $1 billion worth of school programs. So it's not high stakes for them. It's very high stakes for us here. It's $35 million. So we must meet this disparity test.
Yeah, and for the record, too, my district had a real concern about how the impact aid was divided up amongst the districts, and we've had this conversation, and you've been very, very kind to provide me with the information to do the calculation, because it is of the opinion of those people that the state takes the impact aid and we don't get our proportionate share, because what happens is the state makes the application for the impact aid, because the state making the application gets a larger piece of the larger piece of impact aid than if each one of the areas would make their own personal application, and then the money goes to the various districts that the impact aid comes from, and then when the formula funding presents the funding to those districts, then at this time 90% of the amount that they received in impact aid is reduced from the amount that the formula would give them. It was questioning in my mind whether that other 10% covered the proportionate amount of income impact aid that we ought to be getting to offset the 30% that we are then providing for school funding, since the impact is within our district and we are not having any receipt of property taxes that pays the rest of it from that group of people or that area. And so I have that information. I've not provided it for anyone here, but if anyone wants to see the calculations that was given to me by the department, I'd be happy to share that with you. And it's quite equitable, I believe. It's just the thought and theory about it that we don't have control over it, I think, that is most distressing. But I'll have that information to share with my constituents when I go home this summer. Not to answer a question that's really on the front of their mind all the time. Any other questions, Representative Green?
Well, yes, I would very much appreciate a copy of that, because I, too, have to go back to constituents who repeatedly say there is a disparity between urban and rural already, and it seems like every time we do some funding, it appears that it's for rural, additional here, addition there. And so I need to have something that I can understand, that I can explain to them, because right now they're a little bit hot about it.
You know, on that, and I guess I just feel like I must make this statement, is that it is just common fact that when you have smaller things operating, it's the cost per unit is much more expensive than it is when you have larger amounts of things. And I think that if we would stop dividing the school children in our state between rural and urban, and try to determine just exactly how much we're going to have to spend to have each child educated in the same equal way, we could stop worrying about whether or not the rural areas are getting a good deal or not. If I had my choice to put kids in rural schools or urban schools, I'd choose urban schools any day. So I think that the small price that we pay for giving them as good education as we possibly can is honorable and is equitable, and I think we ought not to be so picky. Representative Green.
I certainly agree with you. Thank you, Madam Chairman. I certainly agree with you that there should be no child deprived of an education because of funding where another child gets a benefit because of it. By the same token, I would certainly think it's incumbent upon this committee and the rest of the legislature to be sure that in the single-site areas they are doing everything they can possible to make it more efficient. And if combining administration and other things like that are possible, then it's incumbent upon them and not to keep feeding the fire.
Okay. Okay, well, so much for that. And then we have, yes, sir.
So I'm just going to comment through the chair.
Put your name on the record. I know.
James Elliott. Yeah,
okay.
I had spoken to that earlier. With respect to the single sites, a number of them are contracting for some of their services and trying to economize in that way. Additionally, with respect to the rural, it's important to remember that a dollar in some remote areas of the state do not purchase the same that it does in Anchorage or Fairbanks. So those economies of scales, plus the fact that the value of that dollar is simply not as great.
I understand that.
Okay. Is there anyone here besides the people we have here that we have Virginia Fire? Did I pronounce? All right. Did you wish to testify? Okay. Thank you very much. And if you stand by in case we have more questions or whatever before we finish with this piece of legislation.
Representative James, my name is Virgie Fryer, and I'm from Hoonah, and I am a single-site superintendent, but I'm here to represent the single-site consortium as well as single-site school district superintendents. I want to thank you for the opportunity to talk with you, Mr. Cross and Mr. Jeans and Mr. Elliott have done a really good job, I think, of discussing with you the differences, and so I will be repeating some of the points they brought up. I guess we are a little bit discouraged that the governor's language was taken out of the bill because we felt that would be a good fix for the formula, for the foundation formula. We'd like to stop coming to you every year and whining for the money as much as you would like to have us quit whining for the money. But there are 21 school districts impacted by this legislation. And I've worked in both districts, REAA school districts as an administrator and in single sites. And I think when we start talking about administrative cost, we're thinking of superintendent principal, maybe business managers, but we're not thinking of special services. Our district alone spends $47,000 a year to contract for special services. That's for psychologists, speech therapists, and the like. So it's not as easy for us to get those services as it is for the urban school district. If I lived in Anchorage, it would be much easier to contract those services. The legislation that Section 4 that was brought about for Senate Bill 244 and House Bill 452 was supported by AASB, by AASA, by NEA, the State Board of Education, and by all single-site school districts. I don't pretend to know all the ins and outs between the REAA and the single-site issue. I do, however, realize that until I worked in a single site, I didn't realize what it takes to run one of those districts. And we do a lot of things besides sit in our office and shuffle papers and make trips to the Capitol. We substitute in the classroom. We do things like that. We don't have substitutes out there either in many areas. So we do a lot of things besides prepare the budget and maintain that and so on. I've even driven buses, so you can do a lot of those things when you're out there, and you have to. I really urge you to take a look. I know you're in the last part of this bill and you're wanting to move it along, but I urge you to look again at Section 4 and include the governor's language as part of the bill.
Thank you. We have been from Kentucky, Wanda Cooksey, on teleconference. Wanda, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Would you like to give us your testimony?
I will. I think I can be. I know people say that all the time, but you've covered so much of the information. Can you hear me fine?
Yes, we can.
Okay. You've covered so much of the information, and I think answered many of the questions I would have chosen to try to work at the testimony. A couple things I would point out is the amount of money that's in the budget for this bill this year is as covered already in the budget. It will not be taken from new legislation that you've set aside, so that cost would is in the governor's budget. I'd also like to reinforce the information that this has been done every year but one since the formula that's in existence came on the books. So the legislature has seen fit to look at this as an issue and fund it. And the formula that was in the original bill at Section 4 is exactly the same formula that we've used for the last several years to calculate the grant amounts that went to school districts. So this is an amount that's really become institutionalized into the school's budget, and it has the base on this quota, which, as the superintendent from CUNA said, has been agreed to by everyone, including the 21 single-site school districts.
Thank you, Wanda.
In terms of other things, I would be available for questions because I believe you've covered it quite well.
Okay, thank you, Wanda. Appreciate that. I don't know whether the committee has a copy of the original bill in their packet or not. I didn't have one in mine, and so I've asked my staff to prepare copies. Does anyone else have a copy of the original bill?
I do.
You do. Was it in your packet, or did you?
Well, I was in the HES committee, so I already had a file
oh,
started.
Okay.
So.
All right. Okay. Is there any questions or comments by the committee? Representative Robinson.
I'm not of the speaker.
All
no.
Right. Thank you. Okay, is there any comments then from the committee? Representative Robinson.
Well, yeah, I would like to move, and maybe we need to wait for everybody to get a copy of what the language was, but I'd like to move that we put the original Section 4 back into the bill. It sounds as if there's been a lot of discussion and a lot of work on trying to deal with the disparity issue and to also quit having this as part of the political football that we have every year before the legislature. And I'll be real honest with you. I sat in that committee, and I still don't understand why it was removed.
Well, in response to your comments, Representative Robinson, unless we accept the CS from HES as our working document, the original bill is before us.
Okay. Well, I'm trying to think. How do we move that? So we basically just don't accept that. So we basically
well,
move
we'll
the.
Well, we'll think about that.
Okay. Thanks for giving me that information.
Madam Speaker, isn't this the bill that came over from HES?
Yes.
We have the HES. Yeah, but she was saying unless we accept it, it's not before us. That the
it's not before us at this time because we haven't had a motion on the floor to accept the CS as a working document. In order for us to move forward, the original bill goes forward. It gets changed in committee and becomes a committee substitute and goes to the next committee of referral. In order to use that committee substitute as a working document, we have to have a motion to put that on the floor. Otherwise, the original bill comes to our committee. So I unless someone corrects me and tells me that I'm incorrect in this issue, if we don't put the CS on as a working document, then what's before us is the original bill. Might have my staff check that out and be sure that since our Representative Porter, who is our usually our parliamentarian here, is the one that responds, if you could check that out and see if that's a proper procedure.
Just call Pam if you would.
The bill is currently under consideration as a CS. It was adopted at HES and passed forward to this committee.
That's what I thought, and that's why.
That's the top bill in the yellow packet. Is
right.
The current
right.
Okay.
The motion would be
to make it perfectly clear. We could have a motion that puts the original bill before us as a working document. We could do that. Okay. Representative Robinson.
Well, that's all I'll do then. I'll make a motion that we put the original House Bill number 452, which would be also 9GH2043.A, before us.
Object.
Okay, there's an objection. We will discuss it.
Well, I've stated my reasoning.
Okay. Pardon? That's the original bill. Okay. Is there any other discussion? Representative Ivan.
I'm affected by this legislation, and I'm pro for the language that includes the single-site school districts, and my vote will go that route. I was looking at the sectional analysis and didn't realize the committee substitute before us when I ask questions referencing Section 4.
Representative Robinson?
Well, just the other thing, the reason I think we ought to put this before us, I mean, is clearly part of this has to do with, it's a fiscal issue. I think the bill should go intact up to the Finance Committee. We've been told that the money's in the budget. It's also been stated the money was in the governor's budget. I'm not sure any of us sitting here could guarantee the money's in the budget that we passed on. I guess yesterday y'all passed it out. And so I think it's probably just in the best interest of all the school districts that we move this intact up to the Finance Committee and where they have some of the more intensive knowledge of the workings of the budget and make the final decision.
Representative Green?
Well, I would object to that. The fact that this has gone through the education portion of the HES seems to me that there was good reason in that discussion, and it's unfortunate that the person who's on this committee, who was on that committee, is not quite sure why that happened. But it makes me wonder if this is an education bill, and the purpose we sent it to Hess was because of the education section of that committee, and then we as state affairs say, well, they didn't know what they were talking about. It seems to me that that's undoing the process of going from one committee to another. Might as well just bring everything to the floor.
Well, Representative Green, on your point is that's why we have multiple committees.
Exactly.
And each committee is to put out the bill that they feel is the best bill, and to look at it from a different point of view. And I see that Representative Bundy is here, and he certainly, as chairman of Hess Committee, can talk to us, if he would, on this issue. Representative Bundy, if you would like to come forward. I think that I personally would feel aggrieved if, as a committee, we couldn't make a decision on this bill that is not necessarily building on a previous committee's decisions. Representative Green?
Madam Speaker, that's not what I said, or at least that's not what I meant. What I meant was that the committees are named, and that committee should deal with that portion of the bill, not redo every bill in every committee. That's not what the process is set up to do. We go to state affairs to see how it affects the state, not necessarily education, because that's done in Hess. Not necessarily to check the legality, that's done in judiciary. Not necessarily to see how it impacts our resources, that's done in the resources committee. But if every committee redoes every bill, they might as well go to the floor. That's all I mean.
Before we go on, Representative Bundy, thank you.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you
for coming, and maybe you can put a little light on the decisions that were made in Hess regarding House Bill 452.
Yes, certainly. I assume you're talking about single sites.
Yes, what we're talking about.
And the single sites were rolled into the formula. It's been an ongoing discussion about single sites, certainly as long as we've been here, and good while beyond that. My contention was they were rolled into the formula simply to camouflage the discussion, to lower the level of discussion. And we haven't made a decision on single sites yet. And so it's my contention that funding for single sites should be considered as a separate item until we make an overall policy decision on single sites. And so you can address these as two separate. I've divided the question. You have the formula, and then you have single sites. And that was simply the purpose. Of course, I certainly acknowledge the flexibility, the role of every committee in, and if you take a different take on that and feel that it's not a policy decision, I don't take personal affront. It was just that was my view of it.
Well, Representative Bundy, we just passed this current year budget out of the House just this week. Which included the governor's budget on funding for education, which included the single sites. So it looks to me like, at least for this year, the majority has put an approval on funding single sites. And so, I don't know what the next legislature and ones after that are going to do, but it has seemed to me like we haven't said thumbs down on single site. And here's my question, and we've asked the people from DOE to explain exactly why they wanted to put this in the formula. And this was their response, and I'd like to have your response to that, is that by including the single site calculation, which there is a formula for calculating that, and including it in this piece of legislation, then makes that a part of the formula unit amount. So that, therefore, rather than giving the single sites more units, we're giving them, or a bigger unit, we're giving them something that's within the unit and allows for the disparity of the amount of money that they have to pay per unit.
Well, Madam Chairman, I don't think that what they've done will reduce. The way you describe it, it sounds like single sites would get less money, and that's not the case. It's just merely whether, and I agree, we've agreed to fund single sites. The question I think you have before you is, do you wish to continue funding single sites as a separate item, as we have in the past, to keep them visible, or do you want to submerge them in an entire formula so they become less visible?
Before we go to questions from the committee, I would like to ask the Department of Education, did I explain that quite right or not, on the difference between having them, leaving them out, or putting them in the formula?
Madam Chairman, for the record, Rick Cross, Deputy Commissioner. You were real close. By placing, there is no difference in the amount of money that would be paid to single sites, whether they're out of the formula or in the formula. what would be different is if they're included in the formula, that money would become in the form of more units, additional units. If they're out of the formula, it will increase the unit value. They will get the same number of units, but it will increase the unit value. Increasing the unit value affects disparity. Paying more units does not, and therefore the department prefers that the calculation be made within the formula so that we can give single sites more the same amount of money that would be otherwise, but give it in the form of additional units as opposed to increasing the unit value, which is what occurs when you do it outside.
And of course, if the unit value goes up, then they get more money.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so does everyone else.
Well, I know, and yeah. Do we wish to continue?
Well, and one other question on that issue, Representative Bundy, is that over the past few years, and I don't know how long it is since we've determined that there is this additional cost in the single-site districts, not only because of where they're located, but also because of the relationship between the administrative costs per unit, as it is when there's larger, the administrative cost per unit is less. And there's only been 1 year that those single sites have not been funded, and I believe they suggested it was 1991. I don't know which one it was. I know that in 1993 we didn't, then we did, and then we picked and chose, and we did all those sort of things. So it becomes a political football, and so I guess the question we have before us: do we want to leave it there so we can play with it, or do we really say that it does have some meaning and it ought to be in the formula? I think that's the question: does it have meaning or doesn't it have meaning? And if it doesn't have meaning, maybe we shouldn't do it at all. And if it does have meaning, maybe we should always do it. And I guess that's the question. I'd like to have you respond to that.
Yeah, I think you have summed it up as I see it. Putting it in a formula essentially bless the single sites and says, we're not going to worry about this anymore. The high administrative cost, the inefficiency, the unfairness between rural and urban funding. Leaving it out keeps it up visible where it still will be addressed by the legislature.
Representative Robinson?
Well, how I kind of see it, by addressing in this bill in some way, you've kind of stated, wouldn't this set the policy? And by keeping this in the bill, am I correct, we are setting the policy.
That State Affairs Committee would, I think, then set policy that says single sites are good and we want to take them off the burner.
To the chair.
Robinson, and then we'll have Representative.
Yeah. Then, I mean, of course, the other thing is that we're also sending the bill intact up to the Finance Committee. That would be kind of the final group that makes the decision.
That's true, and they could choose to pull the single sites out if they wished.
And can I say one more thing?
Yes.
And I think the other thing is that I guess I just find exception to the fact that, I mean, I believe there's a lot of urban communities who could tighten their belt and also do a better job in efficiencies, and I don't think it's, I feel like sometimes we just seem to always blame the rural communities and state that it's all the, you know, they're the only ones that are not looking at efficient ways to operate, and I just don't think that's always a fair analysis.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't think that's what I said. I think I know Juneau's asking their teachers to take a 6% decrease. I think they're probably becoming more efficient that way. It would be my contention that they ought to be taking the money out of the administrative budget, which single sites has a very large administrative budget proportion to other sites. But that's a local call if that's what they want to do.
Representative Ivan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry I don't agree with your characterization of the single sites having a high overhead cost. That's always a given in an area in this state the size of, it's like a country. It's so large, and the area cost of living is so, there's a lot of disparity. And the strength of the dollar in urban versus where some of these sites are, I respectfully disagree with your comment. And each year, with the rest of the education or these districts, each year, year after year after year, and not knowing if they're going to be funded. But I see this year they're included in the budget that we've addressed.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Excuse me, just demoted you. Thank you, Madam Chair. My still my pick is not with, with what's necessary, and I certainly understand that there is a difference in cost between rural and urban. My concern, though, is still that if, as we just heard earlier, superintendent of a single-site school, I have been to some urban schools, and they're very well equipped. To think that they would have a superintendent compared to some of the schools in my district, which are much larger, would that justify then on the same basis that each of those has their own superintendent too? My concern is that there should be, with the, in this day of electronic wizardry, that we could have, and we heard that two urban superintendents, rural superintendents, live in an urban environment. So obviously they don't have to be on location. My concern is that it seems that there could be a superintendent covering several rural sites rather than individually. That's my point, and that gets back to the administrative portion, and that's, as I understand, what most of this is for, is our administration. And so my concern is, how can we on one hand say that we're trying to encourage tightening up, not to do with the fact there's a cost differential per student actually in the schoolroom, but the administrative portion. As you said, each single one is more expensive than the sum of the total amount in a single, in a bigger area. I agree with that too. Let's try and work toward that, though, with administrative overhead.
Just a minute. I just have to respond. I think, you know, there's some parallels in this discussion that we're having here. And as a member from Fairbanks, as an example, even though we are an urban area, we feel sympathy with much of these rural areas because we are also, we feel, many times disenfranchised because we're not in Anchorage. And fact is, we're targeted many times because we're not. And fact is, when you start cutting the state budget, what do? You close the Fairbanks office and move everybody to Anchorage. And even you hear testimony on the floor when they're talking about building corrections and wanting to put a new correction facility in Anchorage, and we wanted to remove it so it could be anywhere across the state. And the testimony is that it will cost less in Anchorage because they're closer to this and closer to this and closer to this. We can't move the whole state to Anchorage. You know, people live in where they live, and we have to address the cost of living and the services that they need as citizens of this state, and I believe state affairs is where we address that. And you know, if someone else disagrees with me, you're perfectly welcome to say that.
Madam Chairman, if I...
Representative Bundy.
You might have a closing comment and then leave you to your work. I feel like I'm taking more of your time.
Oh, we're really happy that you came.
You know, I don't disagree with, I think, most of what I've heard here. It is a diverse state. I would, and I, you know, in reaction to what you said, I don't want all those Fairbanks people in Anchorage. We don't have room for that many guns. every dollar that goes to, we have finite dollars for education. Every dollar that goes to hire a single-site superintendent is a dollar less could be in Fairbanks. Is a dollar less could be in Juneau. Is a dollar less could be in the classroom anywhere in the state. I mean, there are different kinds of single sites, I guess, in the state. I'm most familiar with Galena. I have good friends there. And I don't know if you read the Fairbanks Newsminer article on rural schools. Galena has a superintendent who spends, as my understanding, most of his time writing grants so that every one of their students have a power notebook. Well, that's wonderful. I'm really glad that happens for them. But do they need a grant writer that makes $100,000 a year? I don't know. That's a policy decision that we ought to make. We have two single sites here in Southeastern that are 8 miles apart connected by a road. They're single sites because they're different clans. I don't know if that's something that we ought to continue to support a state policy, but this is state affairs, and you folks make your choice. Educationally, I don't think single sites are highly defensible. There are other obvious arguments that come into play other than just educational.
Well, on that response to your comment, I think we're comparing apples and oranges. Right now, we have single sites. If we don't want single sites, we can legislate them together. Mm-hmm. We could say that these two schools will now not be single sites anymore. They will now be this school district. I think as a legislature we have that right to do that. And I think that if that's the issue, that's the issue we ought to be discussing, and that's the legislation we ought to have before us. But right now we have single sites, and I understand this issue, and I tend to agree with what Representative Green says about administrative expenses, whether or not, and what you've said too, Representative Bundy, that with the administrative expenses that we have, on these issues that they ought to be as minimal as possible. I'm certainly going to check with the two districts who have superintendents who live in the urban areas as opposed to in the rural areas and find out just exactly what the cost savings, if there is, for them doing that, or would it be more cost effective if they were in the rural area. I think we can find an answer to that. We don't have that at this table, but I'm certainly interested in pursuing that. I understand from the testimony that we had from Mrs. Farrer, I'm not very good at pronouncing names, not only do we have superintendents, but what we really have is someone who also does superintendent duties. And so I don't think that a superintendent is just a superintendent, it's a lot of other things. So I really appreciate you coming by. You filled a void that we were very much feeling, and I really appreciate
you. Stirred the pot is probably more
likely. I think we needed to hear from you, Representative Bundy. I'm really glad that you came.
Thank you very much. And thank you, and I think you have a very good grasp. If it stays in the formula, we're less likely to address it legislatively. If it comes out of the formula, there's more possibility.
Okay, Representative Robinson.
Well, two things. I'm also glad to find out what we did in Hess. Being that I was on that committee and didn't really quite understand why we had really pulled it. I'm also wondering if we could bring the department back up and respond to Representative Green's comments that he had made that Bundy had responded to.
Mr. Cross, would you come back and
respond?
Madam Chairman, I'm not exactly sure what I'm responding to.
Well, Representative Green's concerns regarding the superintendents, whether or not all these schools need a superintendent. Was that your concern?
Essentially,
want to restate it?
Thank you.
In your own words?
We heard from a single site superintendent, and we understand that there are others. As we just heard from Representative Bundy, two schools 8 miles apart, connected by a road, and those are single-site schools, that sort of thing. My concern was not specific. Mine was more general in the fact that in today's ability to communicate rapidly, fax-wise, television, whatever, that we should be able to combine administrative costs. And it seems to me there are areas of the state that while we know that there's a disparity between the cost of the teacher, the facility, everything in the rural is going to cost more than it is in an urban setting, but there still are economies of scale, it would seem to me, through the administrative portion.
Through the chair, Representative Green, I don't want my answer to sound bureaucratic, but in a way it has to. The law of the state of Alaska right now says that every school district shall have a superintendent, and that the superintendent shall be licensed by the state and have a superintendent's endorsement. So, I mean, that really is that is the answer. So, in terms of economies of scale, while I don't pretend to be an expert on that, my experience is there's a balancing that needs to occur, in that there is such a thing as too small, and you do lose in efficiencies when you're too small. It is my personal belief that there's also such a thing as too large, and that large organizations have a tendency to become less efficient rather than more efficient in many ways. What that exact balance is, I don't know, but I would certainly support discussion and study of that. But the facts are there as they are right now, is our laws say that school districts shall have superintendents. With the issue of the two superintendents that live in urban area, one in Fairbanks and one in Anchorage, those are not single site school districts. They are both of them are REAAs.
Thank you.
Sure.
Is there any other comments or discussion before we go to vote on this? The motion before us is to accept the original bill. Representative Robinson.
Well, just one other thing I wanted to comment to Representative Green's, feelings regarding us, overturning the decision of the Hess Committee. I've certainly had some bills I've worked on where I've watched it go through the Hess Committee and for it to be amended, go through the Judiciary Committee and stay as the Hess Committee and go to the Finance Committee and completely be gutted and go back to the original bill. So, that seems to be the prerogative of committees to make changes, and I think it is our responsibility to look at the issue from the whole state perspective in here, and I believe putting back in Section 4 is the responsible thing to do. And without a doubt, once it goes to the Finance Committee, I have no doubt if they disagree with this committee and they believe that the HES committee was correct, they will remove it.
Well, Representative Robinson, I agree with you 100%. That just very well may happen. I think that as a state, as a state's issue, however, if we're going to be funding single sites as we have been doing, then those single sites ought to be able to expect to get that when they get their formula amount of money. If we're going to choose it to be a political issue each year and decide whether or not to fund it, that puts them in a very distressing situation. The other thing is that I think that, that we're attacking this problem, if there's a problem, and I'm not saying there's not a problem. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying that if there is a problem, this is the wrong way to address it, that if we want to change the law, we have the ability to do that. And if we want to combine schools, we also have an ability to do that, I would think. And that if that's what we really want to do, then that's what we ought to do, as opposed to playing just with these dollars and making them be sitting on a nervous keg and not knowing which way to go. Representative Opens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to associate myself with comments of Representative Green. And I feel if we include Section 4, obviously this area is an area of controversy, and if we include it in the bill, that is pretty much lock it into the formula. And I think it's controversial enough that maybe it needs to be addressed with legislation in the future. So I will vote against.
Okay, is there any other comments or discussion before we call for the vote? Please call the roll. The motion before us is to accept the original bill as the bill that is our working document.
Madam Chair, Vern from the NEA wanted to testify.
Okay.
And also...
okay, we have... we have a motion on the floor. Is there some information that we should know about?
There's an inaccuracy about the superintendents living in Anchorage there with REAA.
Yeah, we figured that out. Actually, this is not the correct time to be taking testimony when we're preparing, because there's a motion on the floor and we're preparing to vote. I believe we should go ahead with the vote at this time, and if whoever's here and wants to testify, we could take their testimony after the vote's taken. Would you please call the roll? Representative Ivan, you have a comment?
We call an Adiz.
Okay, we have an Adiz. Getting back to order, then, we're ready to vote, so would you please call the roll?
Representative Ogan?
No.
Representative Green?
No.
Representative Ivan?
Yes.
Representative Porter? Representative Robinson?
Yes.
Representative Willis?
Yes.
Chair James?
Yes. So now, the House Bill 452 in its original is before us. Is there any more discussion? And we have someone else that wanted to testify.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Vernon Marshall. I'm Executive Director of NEA Alaska. We come to you in support of House Bill 452, a single site funding, and also the opportunity to correct the problem relative to the federal disparity issue that, as I understand, was caused by action that has taken place in the Congress. And we're trying to address today a problem that could very well be on our plates in about 1998. Our concern, and we've issued a paper and also provided some materials, we're concerned that if we do not correct the disparity problem, that and actually allow for the accounting or the consideration of the $35 million in federal impact aid, there will be a proration. And that proration will affect most school districts. And as I understand it, we're looking at somewhere in the area of $2,800 impact on the instructional unit. At the same time, we look at statistics where we've only had one increase in the instructional unit since 1987-88. That occurred in 1992. The instructional unit was raised $1,000. We have looked at that unit in comparison to the cost of inflation as it impacts children. You know, unfortunately, children can't make a choice where they're born. And we have children that need to be educated throughout this state. And I think we at NEA Alaska believe we should educate all the children. But the impacts of inflation are as real in urban Alaska as they are in rural Alaska, probably greater than in some areas. But we encourage this committee, as we have encouraged all committees, to make sure that at a minimum we don't lose ground in our fight to maintain the $61,000 instructional unit. You don't have inflation proofing on the table, but the effects of inflation take away dollars, and I hope you look at the material. That $61,000 unit in 94-95 is only worth $48,000 if you adjust for inflation. And if you look at student funding, the amount we invest in the future of the state, it's also negatively impacted by erosive effects of inflation over the period of time, and roughly that's a 23% reduction because of inflation over the distance of 10 years. We encourage you to pass the bill. We feel that there should not be any threat of negative proration if that should take place, and that ensuring that the state fully get its $35 million and there be no question, no jeopardy, is critical to the education of all children. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay, is there any other discussion before we have a motion to move the bill out of committee? Would somebody like to move that? Representative Robinson?
Yeah, I'll move House Bill number 452 out of committee with the attached fiscal notes. I mean, I have one down on the mail's desk.
Yeah, $223,000.
And with individual recommendations as, I guess, as a new committee, as the bill before us that we adopted.
Okay. Is there any objections?
Objection.
Okay, there's an objection. Will you please call the roll? The motion before us is to move the bill out of committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Representative Ogun?
No.
Representative Green?
No.
Representative Ivan?
Yes.
Representative Porter? Representative Robinson?
Yes.
Representative Willis?
Yes.
Chair James?
Yes. The bill is moved. Okay, we have, incidentally, everyone needs to be on notice that this meeting will be over at 9:30 because of a majority caucus. I forgot to mention that early on, but they've called a caucus at 9:30, so yesterday
everybody
they did that.
Everybody welcome?
Pardon?
Everybody welcome?
No. But some of us need to go. Okay, the next issue up is House Bill 545, Cost of Living Differential Qualifications. Is there someone from the administration here to present this bill?
I'm Pat Nelson from the Department of Law here to answer any questions that you may have.
Okay.
Please come in and make that
all right, thank
available
you.
For questions as well. They don't have a formal presentation.
Okay. Mr. Cummings? Greg O'Clary? Who is Greg O'Clary?
Back by the door.
Okay. Mr. Cummings, you want to come forward then and answer any questions that we have? As I understand it, this piece of legislation is intended to preclude the problem that we had with the ferry workers living outside of the state and collecting cost of living allowance. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am. For the record, my name is Bruce Cummings. I'm with the Alaska Marine Highway System. This is an attempt to clarify the residency criteria and eligibility standards for receipt of cost of living pay based on place of residence that's called for in our collective bargaining statute, the Public Employment Relations Act. The law does require that we pay different rates for people residing in Alaska versus people residing outside of Alaska. And as I'm sure the members of the committee know, there's been considerable controversy about claims for that pay and whether or not people qualify. This is an attempt to more clearly enunciate the criteria by which people will qualify by making it essentially parallel, at least initially, to the permanent fund dividend criteria. It does allow for the adoption of procedures and regulations, under the Administrative Procedures Act, which could vary from current permanent fund dividend regulations. But at the outset, we would simply adopt the permanent fund criteria by reference. And my informal discussion of this matter with the collective bargaining representatives for the vessel employees, it's my understanding that the organized labor does endorse this idea.
Okay, my first question is a little distressed. I'm a little distressed by the intent language. You're saying that the using the permanent fund dividend criteria to determine whether or not a person is a state resident or not is an intent there, because you're saying that the department can change that by regulation. You know how I feel about regulations. Most everybody does.
Yes.
You know, I think the legislature ought to be making law instead of the administration.
Yes, ma'am. To respond to your question, the proposal would allow the Department of Administration to propose and through the APA adopt regulations. What those regulations might be at some point in time is anybody's guess. I guess I can tell you from my limited experience in working with this subject matter that there is a body of sentiment that the permanent fund criteria as currently written is difficult for some people to comprehend. I don't necessarily subscribe to that line of thinking myself, but it doesn't necessarily address all of the factors that might be taken into account, particularly for vessel employees and their living circumstances, alternative lifestyles, and so forth. So you are correct. The law would, as proposed, would allow regulations to be adopted, which could differ from current permanent fund regulations.
And I tend to agree with that statement. However, I'll feel more comfortable if we had it more specific than less specific. Reason being is that when I read the 5 or 10 lines that there are in the definition of qualifying for a permanent fund, the permanent fund division has taken a great license also to define what those things, and some of their definitions wouldn't coincide with my definition of what those kinds of things meant. So I can understand the need to maybe embellish some of those things, but I would find it difficult if we were to put it into law for you to actually change any of those things by regulations. I would think we would need to change the law if that were the case. So I'll hear from other members. Better than Green.
Thank you. This must be my day for being stupid. I'm not quite sure I understand this then. If you use the permanent fund criteria for establishing a residency, how then would that affect somebody? What would you establish as a fair amount of differential pay if, say, they were living in Bellingham or some other place outside the state, but they were in the state enough to meet the 6-month residency requirement?
Representative Green, through the chair, the amount of the differential is currently negotiated. This proposal before you would not affect or propose what the amount of the differential would be. And the amount now varies both by bargaining unit and by job classification within bargaining units, whether a person gets 20% less because they live in Washington, for example. The percentages have always been established across a bargaining table, and this would not change that process. It would, in its simplest terms, it would simply say that if the individual qualifies to receive a permanent fund dividend, they are a resident for purposes of this pay differential we established through bargaining. That's all it does.
Representative Green?
Could I follow up then? Are you saying that wherever they may live within the state, their pay is the same?
Through the chair. It's kind of a yes and no. What you're used to seeing in geographic pay differentials, members of the committee in Title 39, and you have another bill dealing with that subject, is pay for state employees based on where they work, where their position is, whether it's in Juneau or Anchorage or Fairbanks or whatever. We have an anomaly for Marine Highways vessel employees. They are not paid based on a fixed duty station where they work. They are paid based on where they reside. And so we really have only, for purposes of geographic differences, we really only have two rates of pay. Either you're an Alaskan resident and you receive one rate of pay, or you're a non-resident and you receive a different rate of pay. We don't pay people who happen to reside in Ketchikan differently than we do people who live in Juneau, or Haines, or Sitka, or Craig, or wherever they may live. Everybody that lives within Alaska on our vessels is entitled to a differential, and the amount of that differential may vary depending upon their job classification and so forth, but not based on where they reside within the state.
Thank you.
Mr. Cummings, can you define, can you explain to us how we found ourselves in this recent debacle where people that did not live in the state were getting this cost of living allowance? What was the inefficiency in our system that created or allowed that to happen?
Madam Chair, I can't speak from a great deal of personal experience. I'm relatively new to the Marine Highway system. But from what I observed, I was with Department of Transportation at the time. I have been with the state for quite a while. We have been proceeding to pay this cost of living differential pay essentially on a good faith basis. We have historically used what I'll characterize as a rather narrative form of eligibility claim, where the person provides a name and an address, or an ostensible address. And it has been largely accepted on good faith. The Marine Highway system has not had substantial resources to investigate those. I mean, there are no trained professional investigators. We don't follow people around with video cameras, visit their purported homes, you know, the sorts of things you might think of as an investigation of a person's true place of residence and domicile. So that unless there has been some reasonable suspicion of a claim, it really hasn't been investigated at all. And reasonable suspicion has generally arisen because, how to tactfully phrase this, when one employee rats on another. He doesn't really live here.
That's how we find out everything.
But I've investigated several of those myself in the time that I have been there, and of course employees' motives are sometimes questionable. You know, and it's still very difficult to ascertain whether or not a person truly resides in Juneau or Ketchikan versus having that as a shadow residence when they're working week on or week off. Or in the case of our Southwest system, they sometimes work for months at a stretch, as you know, before they even come ashore. And I do believe that some of those reported suspect shadow residences are reported to us for impure motives.
Have the department thought at all about just not having such a cost of living allowance at all, depending on where they live? Because they do spend a lot of their time on the ferry when they're working, especially those summer employees.
Madam Chair, I can't really speak for the department in this matter because we haven't had any real policy meetings on that subject, although there has certainly been some dialogue, and I was around at the time the statute was enacted that required the differential. And I guess I'll speak for myself as a longtime labor relations practitioner and some history of why the differential came into play. I'm not at all convinced that it is appropriate or necessary anymore to deal with this differential, that maybe it should simply be abolished. But that wasn't the sentiment 15 years ago, give or take, when the statute was enacted. It was a legislative decision to provide an incentive for more vessel employees to live in the state of Alaska by providing a higher rate of pay here than we did, say, if you lived in Bayview, Texas, or wherever, and commuted to Alaska. Currently, out of our 700-plus employees, we only have about 50 that do reside outside the state of Alaska, or to the best of our knowledge, reside outside the state of Alaska. And I don't know that would change whether you had a differential or didn't have a differential. Most of them reside in the Pacific Northwest and the Puget Sound area for a host of reasons, including family medical problems or other domestic-related issues. And I just don't know that the geographic differential pay really provides an incentive to move here.
On that point, you know, I don't see an awful lot of benefit these days to encourage people to move here. We don't have any income tax. We give away a permanent fund. We have to pay for schools and all the things that are associated with these people. It seems to me like we might be doing better with the people that live in Washington. You know, that's just a different kind of approach to the situation. But I'm not totally convinced that the benefit to the system and to the state as a whole is there if it's designed to require people to live here to get the higher rate, when it seems to me like that If people did live here, that makes sense. If we wanted to be sure that our workers had enough money to live on and it cost less to be outside, if that was the occasion, but if it was to encourage people to be living in the state, I don't know that that is a really good advantage. I think we ought to make it so that it isn't that advantageous to live here. So, Representative Robinson, you had a question.
Yeah, well, mine was, are the reservation people also included in this through the Marine Highway System? I just remember years ago dealing regarding the PFD, regarding the fact that there would be people who were born and raised here who had to move to Seattle to, that's where the reservation office was, and then no longer were able to continue to be considered as a state citizen. And so, are they part of this also?
Through the chair, and maybe I can respond to both of your questions. No, they are not affected by this. They are, for openers, we no longer have that office, but if we did have an office in Seattle, their pay would be based upon the geographic differentials that are currently provided in 3927020, and you're now looking at a revised version of that in one of these other bills. And again, that's based on where they work rather than where they live. And I perhaps misspoke when I said it was an incentive to bring people here. I mean, obviously part of the rationale was that people who live here had a significantly higher cost of living to maintain than people who lived elsewhere. So, it was really a little bit of both. Although I think it's conventional belief that difference in the cost of living between Seattle and Anchorage or major southeastern communities has certainly gotten much smaller. It's not as significant as it was 15 or 20 years ago.
Mr. Cummings, I think the word is about running out of time, and we're going to have to discuss this at the next meeting. So we do have Mr. O'Clary, who has signed up to testify. I think that I'd like to take his testimony, and then we'll conclude this meeting and carry this over to the next meeting. Representative Ivan?
I'll have some questions, and I'll reserve them to the next.
Okay, all right. Thank you. I appreciate that. So we just keep running out of time. but anyway, we're doing okay.
Madam Chairman, I'm Greg O'Clary. I represent the District Number 1 of the Marine Engineers Beneficial Association. And appearing before your committee today in support of the concept of this bill, I was interested in some of your questions and comments to Mr. Cummings. And the differential law that was passed by the legislature back in the late 70s set up this particular problem that we have been facing over the last 12 years. And I think your comments, Madam Chairman, are germane to solving the problem. If the legislature was of a mind to wipe out that particular statute, I think it would relieve a lot of the stresses between employees that we've experienced. There was a policy in effect with Marine Highways starting in 1963 when they started running the larger ships, when they were required then to provide certain licensed personnel that they could not get within Alaska. It was a requirement to move to Alaska within 4 months of employment. That particular policy was struck down by the courts later because it was unconstitutional to require residency. So the Marine Highway System has been going through this problem off and on for years. The particular law that was enacted in the 70s that set up the differential created these problems. But worse than that, they did not adopt criteria for establishing residency. And it was during the pipeline years on the Hicklin v. Orbeck case that got thrown out on the residency requirement for pipeline hire that, in my view, nobody in the Attorney General's office wanted to touch trying to draft legislation that would stand up in court. So that's why we're here today testifying in favor of the intent of this bill to get criteria to eliminate any further questions or problems with respect to residency.
Appreciate that. Just one quick question, then we got to go. Representative Green.
Thank you very much. When that came to be back in the 70s, did the people who were living in Alaska get a 20% increase, or did the people who were living outside get a 20% decrease?
Madam Chairman, Representative Green, I negotiated that particular contract, and as I recall, I think that we did negotiate an increase. Somewhere in the School of Collective Bargaining, they never taught me to give anything back.
That's true honesty. Okay, well, thank you very much for coming forward today, and sorry we didn't get further with the agenda, but we need to go now, and so we'll conclude this meeting.
You should go to the Republican School of Collective Bargaining.
Are you going to use the same sequence, or we just keep these packages?
Yeah, we keep these packages. Just moving through the